Hey everyone, I'm Jacob Cohen Donnelly and this is A Media Operator. This show is a discussion about building media companies for current and prospective media operators. We discuss business models, products, subscriptions, advertising, commerce, events, everything to help you build your media business. To learn more and to become a premium member of AMO, visit amediaoperator.com/membership and use the coupon code PODCAST10 to get 10% off an annual plan. My guest this week is Jim Van Dye, co-founder and CEO of Axios. In this hour-long conversation, we talked about the importance of advertising for the main business and why they never paywalled that, the company's expansion into niche subscriptions, events, local news, entertainment, and software, how they've structured the team to build these various divisions all at the same time. We dug into a couple of what-ifs tied to mergers and acquisitions, and then ended with his new book, Just the Good Stuff, coming out tomorrow. I hope you enjoy our discussion. Special thanks to Seb Poe for making this episode possible. So I recognize that you're likely doing many of these podcasts in the lead up to your new book launching, Just the Good Stuff. But walk us through the steps of your career that led you to becoming the CEO and founder of Axios today in 2024.
Well, thanks for having me. First of all, love your work, love the podcast. Man, that's a long one to answer here. So, listen, most of my career and kind of what I thought I was going to do with my life was as a journalist. And so for the first, you know, until I was about 35, I was covering politics, came to D.C. to cover politics. I was obsessed with power and how people get it, use it, and abuse it. And I was really obsessed with Congress. And so I came here hoping to be a congressional reporter, eventually made it to roll call, where that's what I did. I covered congressional leadership and happened to do it at a time where the public was really interested in congressional leadership. Newt Gingrich was speaker. There was all kinds of intrigue. There was a lot of just a lot of national attention on Congress, which it back then was kind of rare. And I was good at it, I think. You know, I think there's things that from growing up, from playing poker or being in a small town, being kind of a troublemaker, I was good at getting people on the Hill to tell me things that they probably didn't tell other people. Did that, you know, rose then pretty quickly, went to the Wall Street Journal in my late 20s to cover the presidency and Congress. Did that for about 3-4 years, then did the same thing at the Washington Post. And I kind of thought that's what I was going to do, is just, I was covering the White House, politics, whatever I wanted to at the Post, loved the Washington Post. But I could tell the industry was changing, right? This is, you know, in that 2006 period, you could tell like the internet surging, newspaper readerships declining, people are anxious. And we had an idea and kind of came out of nowhere of, hey, like I was at the Post, I remember talking to John Harris saying, I don't think the Post is as good as we think it is. Like, what if, and this is right when Google was buying YouTube, I said, what if Eric Schmidt came to us and said, what would it take to take on the Post? And the answer was like, not that much. If we could hire 6 of the best people we know and hire 6 up-and-comers and hook ourselves up to the internet and hook ourselves up to cable TV, like we could really make a big difference almost overnight. And we essentially called our own bluff and started Politico. So 6 months from that conversation, we're live with Politico. And that's when I shifted from being, okay, I'm a reporter, kind of an introverted reporter, kind of on my own, to suddenly you're running a company, you're an entrepreneur, eventually became a self-taught CEO and did that for a decade, really fell in love with the starting of things and the running of things, the operating of things, and left Politico and did the same thing with Axios. And when we did Axios, it was very much trying to solve the problem of, you could tell people needed to get smarter across more topics. They didn't have much time, came up with this idea of smart brevity and went out and recruited the smartest people on the most important topics. And, you know, had a lot of success kind of right off the bat. And that's grown into what it is today, which is a much bigger company with, you know, we have verticals, we have a presence in local communities, which I'm sure we'll get into. That's kind of my story, and it's fun. I love this industry. It's a hard industry, almost impossible industry, but it's a fun industry.
You have to really like pain, I think, to work in media in 2024.
I don't think people realize how much pain you got to like. It is hard. It is hard. Very few success stories in the digital era. Man, if your technology's off or your editorial's off or your sales off or your marketing's off, like if everything's not working in synchronicity, your margin for error is so slim because all the big tech companies gobbled up all our money. It's almost impossible, but it's a blast. Like I work as hard today as I did 30, 40 years ago. And I mean, I love it. And I love trying to solve the problem. I think information and news matters. I think having durable brands that people trust matters. And so, you know, I always tell people you should try to do something that you know, get paid for that you would do for free. And I would do this for free. I just love it. I love the space.
So if we look at Axios today, there are a number of divisions or products, depending on how you might think about it internally. And I want to talk about each and every one of them. But to do that, I actually think it helps to take a step back and look at the org chart of Axios, right? Yep. As you've got so many different departments. As the CEO of the business, talk to me about how each of these business units rolls up to you.
Well, it's an interesting question. So, you know, we have just gone through a process where we're trying to diversify the company, right? So if you think about us as a business, we have your traditional ad business that's newsletter and website heavy. We've got this very fast growing events business, and that's a fast growing business for a lot of companies. We've got high end subscriptions. We have a local business. We have a kind of a tiny but growing entertainment business. And so the way that I've tried to structure the company is that each one of those is set up as a business inside the business, almost like a little startup. I try to give, you know, have an editorial lead and a business lead on each one of those. And there's very specific direction about the culture and about what we're selling and how we're selling it and what we're building and how we deliver it. But as long as you stick to that, you have a lot of leeway to just go run that business within your P&L. And so, you know, I have, you know, my COO, Allison Murphy, who's a big fan of yours. Like she operates the company, but she has ownership specifically over local and specifically over the ad business. So as long as they're doing what they need to do, she has a lot of autonomy to do that. Kristen Burkhalter runs events, and you know, she's partnered now with Sarah Gu, who was our editor-in-chief, who we moved over to be executive editor of events because it's such a fast-growing business, and they have a lot of freedom as long as you're delivering first-class events and it's a high-quality editorial product and you're hitting a certain margin. You could go months without getting any direct feedback from me. And sort of that's how we work across each of the Erica Winograd, who's out in LA, who runs the entertainment business. I could go months without talking to her because she knows the type of shows that she's pitching and the type of economics that it would take to land it. And that just takes a long time, right? When you think of operating any company, we're now 7 years in. And so we have a nice structure and a nice culture, but that's, you know, that's after 7 years of sort of getting to this point and figuring out what are the type of people that you need and the operating level. It's the whole game. Like, yes, like we have a great vision. And I think if we're really good at one thing, it's like figuring out with total clarity, like what it is that we want to be and do, and then finding really high quality people to do it. But if you don't have those high quality people, like you can't grow for sure. You couldn't grow. Like local couldn't. I couldn't be in 30 cities with a high quality product if I was micromanaging that, or if I was even really involved in it other than setting things directionally. So that operating level, my leadership team matters profoundly. And then that layer under them matters profoundly. And the layer over them, like it's a, you know, we're about 530 people now total at the media company. You know, it's a lot of people to make sure they know exactly what they need to do each and every day to drive as much value as humanly possible.
And so you talk about how each product has its own business lead and editorial lead. Is the rest of the company then shared services? Like, is it a general account management team, a general like creative team, or does each pod still have their own bespoke teams?
No. So the technology serves all the platforms. The HR talent function serves all of the platforms. The finance office serves all of the platforms. And we even have kind of a centralized operating team just to make sure you're kind of keeping tabs that, you know, that all these things intersect at different places, making sure you're not slowing things down. So there's a lot of shared services that these companies then sit on top of, which you have to do. You just can't afford marketing for us is a centralized function that, you know, yes, you might have embedded people, but you can't afford to have it's a margin of error thing. The margin of error and even the margin of profit is so small in so many areas of media, you can't replicate it like you might replicate it at Facebook or something like that, where you have endless amount of money to spend. So you have to get that shared platform, that shared culture, shared talent operation really down pat. And I think like that's there's a lot of reasons media companies haven't worked, but one of them is it's just they're a very complicated business to run, really complicated, because all those things, your technology, your sales, your marketing, your editorial, have to work in synchronicity and all have to be working at a pretty optimal level. Because if you have janky technology and your distribution's not working or your SEO isn't set up right, you could really hurt and cripple the company. If you have bad editorial content, it means you have bad product, you're gonna die. And if you have a good product but don't have people who can sell it, you're not gonna have money. And so you've got to get all of those things working in as a symphony.
So let's start with core Axios. Back in 2016, you spoke at the Information's New York Subscriber Summit, and you said that your dream was to create a company that doesn't require any advertising. Yep. Obviously now, Axios is still predominantly an ad-based business.
Yep.
When you started, what did you realize as you started building Axios that made you go, wait a second, I've actually got to run ads?
Well, we always planned to run ads. My point at that forum was, in a dream world, you have so much revenue reoccurring through subscriptions that you don't need advertising, which is a very up and down business. So you needed advertising early on, and you need to stay free in advertising as long as you can, as long as you have growth, because that essentially is how you do your marketing. That's how you do your brand awareness. That's how you do your audience acquisition. And so we were lucky in that the ad side of the business, which to this day is the vast majority of our revenue, was bigger than we thought it would be, which then allowed us to grow the brand a little bit bigger and faster than we would have thought, and to be able to have capital to build the company a little quicker than we thought. You know, we did not launch on day one with a high-end subscription model. And remember, we didn't either at Politico. So I remember Politico for the first 5 years, I think my math is right, it's either 4 or 5 years, it was an all advertising business. We didn't introduce Politico Pro until like year 4 or 5. By the time we left, it was a 50-50 business almost. So 50% subscription, 50% advertising. And so, you know, really we only started to introduce the high-end subscription side here in year 4. Right. So those are still baby businesses, like nice trajectory, but baby businesses. So, you know, we benefited a lot from that. And in a minute, our advertising market, which your listeners probably know, but I'll just go a little bit deeper so people realize it. We're basically selling to people who care about what really important people think of their brand or their ideas. So it's not somebody trying to sell a product. You would almost never advertise with Axios to sell a product, because we don't have the scale and we don't have the precision matchup tools that you would get on social platforms. What we do have is a super elite audience of decision makers at companies, at technology companies, in politics, in policy, leaders in the media who are reading us religiously. And if you care what those people think about your brand or your idea, there aren't that many places that are clean and well-lit and safe to advertise, and that's our sweet spot. That's where we make, to this day, the vast majority of our money.
A former colleague of mine likes to talk about what he refers to as the trap of generality, where everything on the internet ultimately just becomes general news. You chase politics, you chase sports. It could be argued that when you launched Axios, you intentionally went into this potential trap, and yet it worked. Why has it worked so well for Axios being a more general interest news publication versus so many others who have failed at this?
Now, that's interesting because I would never describe ourselves as a general interest publication. I would describe ourselves as a broad based of interests that we care about, but with almost like a niche mentality to each of those, right? We wanted somebody who had true domain expertise on a topic that matters. Sarah Fisher in media, Dan Primack in technology, Alex Thompson on Biden. You go down the list. And so the idea is, here are the topics that a smart professional would care about. Here is the person who we think is the best in the business at doing it. If we can aggregate all of those audiences together, you start to have not the scale of the New York Times, but a pretty big scale of people. And so, yes, you're hitting across healthcare and you're hitting across politics and you're hitting across AI, but you're doing it through the lens of expertise. And that really, we've doubled down on that, but that hasn't changed. I wholly agree that anything that is general interest, anything that's commodity, and I've felt this for 15 years, you're doomed to be dead. Because there's no market for it. It is a commodity. It doesn't have intrinsic value. It isn't something that you can only get in one place. You have to have something that is distinctive. And for us, a distinctiveness, if you reverse engineer the company, the thing we did that turned out to be right was smart brevity. And it was both parts of it. It was smart, really smart journalists offering distinctive coverage. But the brevity part, I would argue, was as, if not more important, this idea of bringing efficiency to high-end information creation and consumption. The marriage of those two met the consumer need. And again, like reverse engineering the company, I'd go back one layer further, and I would say the thing we got most right was the first two words of that manifesto, and they haven't changed to this day, reader first. We basically sat down and said, screw what we want. I don't care what the New York Times is doing or what we did at Politico. What do we know that the smart professional needs? How do they want it delivered? And how do we produce that? And how do we make that the only thing we care about? So in those early days, we would sit there. When we decided to start Axios, I shut my laptop and I've looked at a computer screen. I've worked on a computer fewer than six times in 7 years. Everything I've ever done, I do on the phone. And the reason was I had to become the consumer, and they were going to get 80% of their content on the phone. And so we would stress about every pixel on the phone or every pixel in the layout of a newsletter to make it as user-friendly and delightful as possible, almost like you were building a shoe for somebody who's a shoe enthusiast. Like you'd care about the comfort and you'd care about the style and the shoelaces and the material. And ultimately, that person is going to wear that shoe because there's something delightful and unique and distinctive about it. We felt that same way about the content experience. And I think that is a huge mistake that media companies make. They do things that they think are cool, that they want to do, without first asking themselves, what does the reader, the listener, the watcher, what do they want? What do they need? How do you make them happy?
And so as time goes on, do you see the core part of Axios continuing to be a growth area, or do you view it more now as a top of funnel to all the other business units that you've launched?
I mean, hopefully a growth area, and it was an explosive growth area until last year. That was a really hard year for everyone. We still grew, but it wasn't 30, 40% in the core business, right? You're talking single digit growth. I hope it continues to grow. And again, we are a new enough brand that there's tons of people who've never read us, right? There's still a lot of acquisition to do out there. So I think the core of the brand can grow, but we're diversifying now because I think we're on the edge, maybe we're 6 months or 18 months away, but we're on the edge of a profound shift in the relationship between human and information. And so the way that we think about businesses is we think about, okay, Mike and I went out to Silicon Valley and spent an inordinate amount of time with people at Apple, Amazon, Anthropic, OpenAI, Character AI, all these companies, not saying how can we get money from them, and we would take money if they want to pay for the content, but it's more like, what is the world going to look like in 18 months or 2 years? And how do we engineer Axios now to be ready for that disruption? Almost like you, what would have happened if you knew the internet was coming before the internet came? And we kind of know there's going to be this huge platform shift. How do we get ourselves ready for that? And our belief is, okay, there's a couple of fundamental things about humans and information that we don't think will change. People are going to always need, especially smart professionals who are looking to news to probably get ahead at work, really, fundamentally. They're going to always need expertise, the nuance of breaking news, of getting people to tell you things they shouldn't tell you, the historical context that they have that a machine's not going to replicate. They're going to need human connectivity with like-minded people around passion topics. So that's why we're investing heavily in events. That fraternity of content consumption, we're launching a membership program, just did it around communicators, where we charge a decent amount of money, but you get to go to events, you get access to proprietary data or information. Those things, alongside of trust, like, oh, the world's on fire, I don't trust anything, but oh, if it's written by Axios, I know them, I trust them, it's in this secure package that they're delivering me. Those things will have a tremendous amount of value. And so it's a long way of getting to your thing of like, will the national business grow? I hope so. I hope it continues to, but we're diversifying, knowing that it's not going to grow 30, 40% a year, probably ever again. It's off of too big of a base.
So you launched your first subscription product in 2022, 5 years after launching Axios, the national brand. Yep. Can you talk about this offering and why you decided to take the approach of niche newsletters versus, say, gating the entire site like so many other media companies have done?
Yes. Let me take the last part first. So the decision with do you have a paywall, right? The upside of a paywall is that if you can be one of the chosen few and you get a big enough subscription base, even consumer-based subscribers tend to renew in the 80% plus range. So it's a nice business. The flip side of that is it limits the amount of exposure to your brand, and it limits the amount of engagement with content, which therefore limits the amount of advertising. So for us, because the advertising business was and is so attractive, I don't want to reduce the amount of content that I'm producing, because we're going to make more money off of advertising than we would off of that paywall. So then what we said is, okay, yes, but we want gated content. And so, you know, we basically did what we did at Politico, which is create additive content above and beyond the base of your content that is more micro-focused around niches. And the two niches that we picked were the Dan Primack universe of deals, like people in venture, private equity, banks, who are transacting in deals, right? In buying and selling companies or stocks. And then our version of what we did at Politico Pro, which is Axios Pro, around policy. And we did it around newsletters because even to this day, it is the best vehicle for getting high-end content from us to the end user. Like the stupidest thing, the dumbest thing, I always get a kick out of people who are the groupthink that takes on. But remember like a year ago where everyone's like, oh, it's peak newsletter. It's peak newsletter. And I remember it's like looking at the, I'm like, what are these people seeing? Like I'm looking at engagement of newsletters, subscribers is going up and open rates going up. And advertisers have no idea how to even get smart people to engage in content other than through a newsletter. Like, what are you, peak newsletter? Yeah, maybe people are doing a lot of newsletters and maybe the consumer is getting a little overwhelmed. But if anything, now newsletters are more valuable than ever. You can't get, like, you're losing your audience that you had on Facebook. You're losing the audience that you had on Twitter. And most of us are still very strong on Google search, but make no mistake, it is a flop. Google is a flop if you are still searching for information 2 years from now. If you don't have some kind of chip in your brain that's just answering those questions that is brought to you by Google, they failed. And so they're not going to fail. Like, it's going to, search is going to be replaced by generative AI and these personal assistants. And okay, so, but what's left standing? People who come to your app, people come to your site, people who subscribe to newsletters. Something else will come along, but like, those are pretty powerful things to have. What was the other? That was a long answer. I missed your first part.
Oh, well, just ultimately, you know, why did you pick these niches in newsletter form, which you did answer, but then I as a follow-up, how did you pinpoint the price that you wanted to charge for them?
I mean, there's no, I love that. I'll tell you a funny story that we'll get to it. So when we were starting Politico Pro, God, that was it, 12 years ago, I'm getting old, whatever it was, like 12 years ago, we had, it's really me and Roy that were pushing it. And Bloomberg was starting BGov, and they had hired all these McKinsey guys. And they wanted to do a meeting, and I think we were talking about, do we merge? Could one of us buy the other? And we had this discussion about pricing. And we had come up with, like, I think $5,000 was our price back then, and they had $7,000 or something like that. And they were, oh, we hired focus groups and data people and this algorithm and that. And we found out that 6,999 is the perfect number. And they're like, how did you guys come to 5,000? And Roy and I look at each other. I'm like, I don't know. 4,000 seemed low. 6,000 seemed high. 5,000 felt right. So, like, there's no magical formula. You want to get in high enough. You know, it's easier to reduce a price than it is to increase a price. You want to get in high enough where, if it works, you're going to be able to bring in enough revenue, but low enough to get enough people to test the product. And, you know, people were accustomed to paying, you know, 400 plus for the information, and that we were getting in the venture space. So 599 felt like that's close enough that you're not going to scare people off. You know, the policy product was basically priced right around 5,000, which is lower than BGov and lower than Politico, mainly because we want to get customers and get people used to consuming content our way. But we're not big focus group data overthinking people. Like, we feel like we know the market, we'll take chances, we'll adjust if we need to, but all the time people waste with all these stupid things where they think that they give you a magical answer that they don't. Like, you're better off kind of trusting your gut and then, you know, fixing it if you're wrong.
I mean, I was going to charge $100 a year because that's what Substack said, and then I decided to slide my finger over one number to 200 and said that feels better, and it was still wrong. Most of my audience says they'd be willing to pay 50% more than that, so I'll be fixing that soon.
I mean, and the reason, but the, like, which is smart on your end, but the reason is, like, at the end of the day, we're dealing with customers. Once you get into the $200-$300 plus range, that they're either, it's a business expense or it's business related enough that they're willing to pay for it. All that matters is, do you deliver the goods? If you deliver the goods, they're going to pay $600. They might pay $6,000 if you're really good, right? You don't. It's all about, can you deliver the goods? And I think, like, that is the thing we've always tried to focus on, is like, if we're not smart, if we're not efficient, if we're not delivering value, the price doesn't matter. If we are, like, the price will work itself out.
Axios Entertainment is a new initiative for the business, but it's not your first foray into, you could argue, TV content, because you had Axios on HBO. Can you talk about A, Axios Entertainment, and B, what is the strategic rationale behind doing these sorts of multimedia projects?
Yeah, so Axios Entertainment is a relatively small group headed by Erica Winograd, who's out in LA, who has a background in conceiving of original programming, documentary programming. And then she has a small team that helps kind of think and bring these ideas to life. And then the idea is go partner with production companies and go pitch platforms like Amazon, Netflix, Apple, HBO, Showtime to buy your programming. So we just sold a show called Money Game to Amazon that we're doing in partnership with a production company called Campfire out in Hollywood. You know, it's a many million dollar deal where we have the exclusive rights to all of the players at LSU as they go from being a gymnast, basketball player, football player to being able to make money through name, image, likeness, called Money Game. And what happens? Like, just their life, the economics of it. So, cool idea. And we've sold that show, and now it'll air on Amazon this fall. The idea is, listen, the way we look at Axios is not through where are we today. It's 10 years from now, there's going to be a couple of media companies that are kind of known national or international brands. And what are the attributes of those companies? And I think one of the attributes can be, and probably will be, that you're able to engage people who care about serious content in a bunch of different ways. Maybe it's in person in an event, but also through documentary films or through shows that are based on the IP that we create through the journalism that we do. You know, it's an experiment. It's a small thing. Like, the early signs are good on it. It's not going to make or break the company, but I do think if we can nail it, it's just another way to expose people to the Axios brand. To be blunt, it also, you know, strengthens our relationship with people in the production world. Shaquille O'Neal, for instance, is a partner on the Amazon deal, and if that works, and maybe do something else with him. Or, you know, we're pitching a show right now in the market with Tom Brady's production company and on leadership, and, you know, maybe something happens there. And then you get better relationships with these platforms, and you hear more about what they're interested in, and you find more stuff that is adjacent to what Axios cares about, AI or healthcare or the energy revolution or politics. And that's the play there. And then we'll see. You know, over time, for it to be a real business, you have to own the production of the films, which we don't, right? We're the idea creator, we're the connector. But if we really wanted to do this long term, we would either buy a studio, or we are, you know, buy a production company, or build it ourselves.
And so is the way to minimize the downside of this to focus on the ideas right now until you prove that you have that? And
Bingo. Yeah, there's no cost. It's just a couple of people conceiving of ideas. You sell it, you sell a couple of shows, you've more than paid for that. Get start to strengthen your reputation, and then you start to bring in some of the production. And then listen, Vox, I don't know how they're doing now with it, but they had a really good business around production. They made it one of the things that they were focused on, and it became a, you know, many tens of millions of dollar business for them with a decent margin. And they ended up becoming a production company themselves. I don't know where that stands now. I haven't talked to them in a while, but I assume that's still going.
There is a lot going on at media companies, whether that's media planning, ad operations, customer service, you name it, there are things to do. And that means you need people to do those tasks and managers to manage those people. All of this critical work is resource intensive, and this year it is sure to get busier. What if there was another way? Enter SEBPO. SEBPO is a leading global outsourcing partner that serves the advertising, media, and technology industries by taking on your organization's repeatable back-end tasks. With staff in the United States, Bangladesh, and El Salvador, SEBPO teams become an integral part of your company by taking on the multitude of tasks required to run an efficient media company. And this isn't just about throwing people at the problem. SEBPO follows an in-depth implementation process that ensures they execute the right strategies and supporting tasks to help your business thrive. Then, they deploy the necessary team and partner with you to train them on your processes. SEBPO will help you scale your business and allow you to focus on the strategies and tasks that require your expertise. If you're interested in learning more about outsourcing these sorts of tasks and more, email sales@sebpo.com or visit sebpo.com to set up a call. All right, so we talked national Axios, we've talked subscriptions, we've talked entertainment. For most operators, that would be enough. For you, it's not. Now we move to local. You decided to acquire, was it Axios Charlotte? Yep. A few years ago, and then roll out a ton of different local pubs. Yep. Talk a little bit about the strategy here and the advertising business specifically. How does it make money?
Yeah. Like you said, we like pain. So rewind a couple years. So basically, one of the things that we do, and it served us well, is if everyone in the media thinks something's true, go the opposite direction. It's a very safe bet to make. And people are like, they're hopeless about local. And I get why they're hopeless about local. But what we realize is, well, wait a second. Like, people are still in these cities. They still care about what's happening. And if you can reach them, there's still advertisers who want to reach them. And the advantage of today is, particularly after COVID, but even pre-COVID, people don't need to work in a building, so you don't need to buy or lease a building, and you don't need a newspaper or paper boys and girls to deliver it. So you just took away your two biggest cost drivers. So then the question is, what is the lowest cost way to create a daily habit with a serious group of readers that you could then monetize? So we came up with this idea of Axios Local. Like, let's take the Mike Allen formula. Let's find one or two. Two is the number we settled on, and that now it's more than that. But in two people who are the most wired reporters in a city like Minneapolis, and create a morning habit of a newsletter, which if you do it right, if the layout's right, if you have the right people, the right voice, you can do. Let's lock those people down. Let's start to see if we can sell against it. And as we grow the revenue, we will grow the size of the staff. So we don't collapse ourselves on day one because we took on too much cost. In the middle of this, you know, this guy, Ted Williams, is running this company called Charlotte Agenda. I remember being at National Airport. He calls me. He's like, yeah, you don't know me. I have the Charlotte Agenda. I got eight people. I saw what you guys are doing in local. You should buy me. And then I'm going to show you how to do this other places. And he's a really straight shooter. He's like, this is how much money we make. This is how much it costs. I was like, holy shit, you're making money off of local. I think the number at the time was like, maybe they were doing about 2.5 in revenue, so 2.5 million, but 1.5 in cost. I was like, well, that's not bad. If I could do that in 100 cities, like, we were off to the races. And he's like, not only will I tell you the revenue and the cost, he goes, if you give me X amount, I'll sell you the company. And I'm not even kidding. We don't even really have to negotiate. And it wasn't that big of a number. He goes, but I want to help build this out. And so, like, our only due diligence was he had 8 or 9 employees. I wanted to make sure we met them to make sure they would fit culturally. We have a pretty unique culture here. And we loved all of them. And so we bought them. And that has been very much a template for going into these other cities, which is this mix of what's happening in politics or business or technology, but an equal mix of, like, what's the city like? Like, what's cool? What are the new restaurants? What are the new bars? Who are the cool people that live here? So it's like a mix of that in each of these. You know, we ended up, now we're in 30 cities, but we started, I think that first batch was Des Moines, Denver, Minneapolis, Tampa. I think that's right. Twin Cities, Tampa. And, you know, and we were able to do what we thought we could do. Like, oh my God, we suddenly, you know, we're able to get to our first marker was 50,000 readers with a 50% open rate. You know, we're now, I think there's at least 10 or 11 cities that are 100,000 readers getting the 100,000 subscribers to the newsletter in that city, by that city, for that city, with a, you know, roughly a 50% open rate. And now the big test is that we're in 30, and then eventually we're in 30 cities now. So now the test is, I'm very confident we have product market fit. I think the fact that we get to that scale with that kind of consistent open rate and then look at the anecdotal feedback, we have product market fit. The next test, and the one we're trying to validate as quickly as possible, is can we change local buying habits to make this a regular part of their buying cycle so that we can get each one of these cities to profitability in a 3 to 5 year time period? So break down a city. So a city, if you have 2 or 3 reporters, even with the allocation of other costs, your cost is less than $1 million per city. So you need to be able to get to, let's say, $1.2 million in revenue. And ideally, most of that is local. So early on, we had a lot of success selling, but it was not a false indicator, but maybe it was a little bit of a false indicator. National buyers wanted to reach smart professionals in those, would pay a premium, so they would buy out a lot of the newsletters, so we couldn't actually sell to local. So really only in the last year did we hired a guy who, Roop, who had been at Nextdoor. He's now running local sales. He has a local sales team. We're now starting this last quarter. We had by far and away, I think Uber came in for the biggest buy we've ever had local, biggest event sale ever, most clients spending $100,000 or more. So like the signs are good. I'm not at 100% to declare victory. Like I have to be able to see something other than Charlotte, which has continued to grow and sustain its profitability number. I have to be able to see that in the other cities before we move on from 30. And that's what we're in the middle of. which is just a really cool experiment. And what I tell our team is, if we get local right, it will be a bigger achievement than starting Axios or Politico. It's that hard, because everyone says it can't be done. No one's been able to do it. It doesn't seem doable. So if we pull it off, not only will it be important, it will be, I think it'll be the thing that I will look back on that I'm most proud of, just understanding the level of difficulty. And so, you know, we'll see. I really hope by the end of this year, we'll have validated it. And if not, we'll validate it early next year. The trajectory is good to very good. It's not, I want to get to about 92% certainty before I would say, now we're off to the races. But once we get off to the races, the hope is now we're really off. Once we have it, and having Cox as a partner that thinks generationally, the minute that we know we have it, then we're going to go into 50, 100. Maybe I could lay out a scenario where we could be in every town, no matter how big, like especially when AI really starts to pick up. That would be the exciting thing to do. So we'll see. I mean, it's still in the early stages.
Last year, Digiday reported that your event revenue was greater in 2023 than you had originally budgeted. What is the overall event strategy for Axios, considering you have so many of these different business units?
Yeah, the overall, like I think last year, the events business off a pretty good base grew 60%. And this year, it's on track to probably do 30% or better. The event strategy is just to put on the best possible live journalism show that is truly newsy with truly interesting people and is respectful of your time, and to make it worthwhile for that audience and make it a sensationally worthwhile for the advertiser, the sponsor who's there and excited to convene people around a topic. Most of that is national. The biggest growth has been around these kind of bigger events. Like we did a lot of events around Davos, around COP. We're doing a lot around AI now. We have a couple different AI summits. We have BFD, which are these investment summits built around Dan Primack and his audience. Those are, you know, much bigger. You know, those are, you're getting into the, you know, close to $1 million, often plus, in sponsorship for big events like that. But we do a lot of $100,000 events, or in local communities, $10,000 or $20,000 events. And so the idea is to keep growing that. Like, there's no reason that couldn't be a huge, huge company, because just think about yourself and the world. The more artificial and virtual the world comes, the more valuable live events are, right? Because people are just, they're hungry for connection, but not just connection. They're hungry for smart connection around a shared passion topic, almost always related to work. If you can do that, there's a really interesting business to be had. And so, you know, we've got, like, Kristen runs the business side. Sarah, now, who ran our entire newsroom, is running that. I mean, that's how much how bullish we are on that space. And the idea is just to keep being really smart. There's a lot of people who are competitive in that space with us. But if we can keep being a blue chip or kind of seen as the best in that space, I feel very confident it'll keep growing at this percentage rate.
Why did you ultimately decide to divest Axios HQ?
So people don't understand, Axios HQ was a business we created within Axios. And it was, we had a bunch of companies come to us who their executive teams loved Axios newsletters. They loved Smart Brevity. And they said, will you teach us to write? And our first response was, no, not my job. But then the more people who said it were like, wow, something's going on that these big companies, including like United Health Group or BP, JP Morgan Chase, the NBA, they all called us with and used almost the same language. So we're like, oh, man, something's going on here. Myself, Roy, others, we dug in, and it turned out that internal communications in every company, big or small, was a hot mess. They didn't know how to bring smarts and efficiency to it. So we created at first a training program and then software. And now we have very sophisticated AI software that helps communicators or helps managers or leaders communicate more efficiently, be able to measure it, and be able to track that communication so you can start to bring real value to it. That's the context. So then when we did the deal with Cox, we see a huge, huge upside in that SaaS type business. It needed to get capitalized differently because a SaaS company gets valued differently than a media company. So when we did the deal with Cox, who ended up buying a majority stake of the media company, we were insistent, and we had been insistent when we had talked to Axel Springer and others about buying the company, that we wanted at transaction point to split off HQ into its own entity. We would help capitalize the company. We would get other investors to capitalize it. And then Roy Schwartz, who is one of the three co-founders, who, you know, was born to be a CEO, but like I was a CEO, like you're only going to probably have one. And he's like a better businessman than I am. He wanted to go run that company. So we did that. When we did the transaction, we split it off. Roy is now the CEO of HQ. It's a sister company, but it's completely separate of the media company, and it's doing exceptionally well. It's definitely kind of on the cutting edge of using AI and creating an AI co-pilot for communicators, and it's a great product. And so, you know, we being more than you probably need to know, like me, Mike, and Roy are the, you know, we're the biggest shareholders in that company, but Cox is also a minority shareholder. Then on the media company, Cox is the majority shareholder. We continue to be shareholders, but they own the vast majority of the company.
So we've talked about, I think we've talked about every single core product that Axios has. If you had to break revenue down for the entire corporate structure across those various divisions, what would be the percentages?
So, man, I wish I had that in front of me. subscription is still, even subscription with membership, high end, is still 5% of the revenue. So let's say 95% of it is in advertising. Probably, God, I'm going to probably get these wrong. Let's say 10% is local, and then the rest is national. And of the national, let's do the math in my head. 25% of national would be events, and the rest would be advertising.
And where do you expect to finish 2024 from a revenue perspective?
Obviously we hope to be up. I think we project to be up overall as a company in the 15% range, right? Because it's a really hard time. It's just I find this period, the last 18 months, the hardest period in 15 years to budget in. I really only budget confidently now in quarter to quarter. The world's just changing too fast. So Q1 was good and with signs that the rest of the year is going to be like strong good, like definitely different than last year. It's not 4 years ago, like where like there's just a lot of money out there. It's still really hard environment. It's a better environment than last year. I'm reasonably confident that the economy is not going to like tank to the point that it would reverse what we're seeing right now. But it's still a difficult environment. I tell our people all the time, like it's still a fight every single day for every single dollar. But my hope is we end up with solid double digit growth this year. That would make me feel good. What would make me feel even better is that these emerging lines of business are doing the things behaviorally that we want them to do. And that's why Cox has been like just a godsend. They're just a great company with a similar culture, and they're so big that they think in 20-year increments, and they really want Axios to be a decade from now the way we would have seen CNN in its heyday, like just a dominant publication that reaches people in a variety of way and stands for truth. And I think, you know, like there's no guarantee we'll get there or anywhere close to that, but I feel like we've set the foundation to do that, and shame on us if we don't execute on it. But that's a lot of work. It's a lot of things that have to go right.
In a recent Times article, you talked about the $1,000 per year membership product that you're building and said, quote, I'm trying to align the company with the people who have a ton of talent. They thrive, we thrive. And so when I wrote about this in AMO, I said that as media companies, we need to better incentivize our star talent.
Yep.
When you think about this membership product specifically, how do you think about incentivizing that talent? How do you think about incentivizing Sarah or Dan or, you know?
It's hard, right? Because what you want to do is you want to, in an ideal world, you would incentivize them wholly based on the growth of their product. I don't love that model for them or for us because they don't really control the sales of the product. They don't control the advertising buy. They don't even control the outward selling of the individual product. So they could either be, they could be punished if they might be producing an A-plus product, but maybe the selling wasn't right. And so the way that we try to align it is we do try to put together an aggressive package of bonuses, salary, incentives, where they're being paid as stars, right? We have to be confident that there's just going to be some reporters who make a lot more than other reporters because they drive a hell of a lot of business and they drive value that a generalist or somebody who's not a franchise player drives. And my hope is, like with the membership program and the subscriptions and getting people on stage, my hope is over time, people like yourself. So let's say like you build out this business and you're the media operator and you start to, you get a decent following and you could derive subscription dollars off of that, maybe events and maybe advertising, but you're lonely. You're like, you know what? This is hard, man. Like, I don't have anyone to talk to, no one to bounce ideas off of. Man, it'd be nice to collaborate with somebody who is on the technology beat. Man, I'd love to do a conference, but I don't have a team. My hope is that people like you then see us as that's the place to go. Like, if I'm the best of the best, I want to go there because I'm going to get the best of both worlds. I'm going to be able to make more money than I thought I could make. I'm going to be able to become an even bigger presence or a bigger star. But I'm also going to have the trappings of a company that cares about me and can give me these other pieces of support, right? That's the flaw of Substack, right? Like Substack is, and they're trying to remedy that a little bit, but it's a little lonely, right? And not, most people aren't wired that way. Very few are actually. And some have done it exceptionally well, but I think most people in the end are going to want people in support. And I hope that we're seen as the place to go if you are at the top of your game and have some kind of dominance in a niche beat.
Industry Dive sold for a few hundred million dollars, and I guess more depending on incentives. Politico sold for $1 billion. You sold for $525 million. What are they putting into the DC water that makes all these media companies sell for so much down there?
Listen, like in some ways, if we're being blunt, media companies are a little bit like NFL franchises, right? They're a prestige asset for a lot of people. So they carry, if done right, they carry a multiple you're just not going to get for most businesses. Or to be blunt, you might not get it based on the business that you're looking at on a spreadsheet. You just love the space. You love the, hey, man, like the guy owned Politico, right? Like there's just a, there is something about that. I think the reason that they're DC based and all of the ones that you just mentioned is they are businesses, right? And they're businesses that, let's be blunt, they feed off of the city, which is people want influence. People want to influence political insiders through advertising. There's not that many ways to do it. Or in Industry Dive's case, they were DC based, but they realized that if they could go through these micro niches and get sort of the most powerful readers and things like wastewater treatment, that there's real value there. Very smart people who ran that, very smart exit for all of them. So there is an advantage if you understand the economics of DC to doing it in DC.
So you've got a new book coming out, Just the Good Stuff, and I want to run through a couple of what ifs with you.
Yep.
First one, I read this last night. Axel Springer almost bought you guys.
Yep.
But as time went on, and I won't put words in your mouth, people should read the book, you found that the opportunity of merging with Politico to be just not that interesting. But let's assume that using your words, that revenge feeling that you had won out, and you actually decided to go forward with that deal, and you became the CEO of Axios and Politico in that combined entity. What would you have done to make that combined entity a success?
I mean, there was a point in time where we thought about it. They came to us, they wanted to buy us and Politico and put us in charge of it. So I put thought into that. It didn't excite me in a way that I think that they thought it would excite me. I mean, what I would have done is like done what we've done here. And I would have, you know, like I feel very strongly there's a certain type of culture that you have to create. I think you have to find people who can have true beat dominance, BEAT dominance on every single thing that Politico touches or that we touch. You'd probably want to get rid of the overlap between the two companies. And you would want to be the most important publication for people in power across every single sector. And that would have been the playbook if we had done that. There's a lot of problems with that deal. Like one, I don't think Axel would have been the right partner for us. I like Matthias Stoffner. I like that he cares about journalism. You know, he's got really strong political views that I think he probably wants to impose on his publications that would have made me deeply uncomfortable. And we both have strong feelings. Like now watching him in action and knowing myself, I think we would have collided a lot. I think we both have strong personalities and strong views. And that probably would not have been a great marriage over time. And, you know, I don't know that I write in the book about peacetime leaders and wartime leaders. I don't know that I'm the best peacetime guy. I think I'm a good wartime guy. Like I'm good when it's hard and you're trying to do a bunch of things that people say you can't do and you're willing to take some risks and you're willing to hire like other people who are wired like you. You know, you get into a big company, and Politico's a big company now. It's, you know, it's a 1,200 people, and there's like a peacetime dimension to it of like, do you have the right processes, right? Are you operating it efficiently? Like, that's just not Jim's gig. Like, I have other people who could do it, but like, I don't know. And I thought about this a lot even when we left Politico. Like, would we go run a different publication? Ugh, like cleaning up other people's stuff or trying to, impose a culture on people who are resistant to it. You only would understand what I'm saying, like once you've like run like something that's like 500 people, like it's so hard, man. People are so difficult. And like once you figure out what you want to be around, and like Axios is like 525 people who are just they're high achieving, they're ass kickers, but they're good people. And like the idea of going back in, and most of the people that were at Politico were hired after I left, like that just does not sound fun. I like fun.
Around the same time that the Politico Axios stuff is going on, there are reports that you're also exploring a merger with The Athletic. Was that true?
True that we talked. True that like we admired them, and I think they admired us. We met. To LA, wherever they were, we spent a day whiteboarding, like, what could this look like? It wasn't an obvious marriage, right? Like, there's just not that much that was, okay, here's Axios and here's The Athletic. There's not a lot of overlap. And so and it's not really clear what we would have brought to them or they would have brought to us. And so, yes, we talked, but it was never, we never got so close as to talk specific numbers or let's really engage in this. You know, back then there's a lot of talk because there's a lot of people circling around that wanted to buy up all these publications and put them together. And so there's different people who are like, oh, we'll put together Axios and The Athletic and maybe we could buy The Information. Like there's all these weird people who thought they could put together these combos. They typically don't work. And by the way, I remember walking away thinking the company that should buy The Athletic is the New York Times, because the New York Times needed subscription growth and they did have subscribers, and the New York Times is really good at getting more subscribers, and Athletic needed help boosting their subscription base. And so I think, I don't know how the New York Times feels about that today, but it struck me as a smart purchase, and I'm a big fan of The Athletic. I read it a lot. Read the Times a lot. But it wouldn't have been a good fit with us.
Do you watch Hot Ones?
No. What is it?
Okay. All right. It's a YouTube show where two people eat chicken wings that get progressively hotter, and then at the end, everyone's crying because it's too hot. But I won't go too much deeper into that. All right. So before we end with the same two questions that I ask every operator that comes on the show, I want to give you a minute to tell us about your book that's coming out.
Okay. So the book is Just the Good Stuff. It comes out tomorrow. And it's basically, I was in this rare position where I started two companies, I ran two companies, and I'm a journalist. So I kept very close notes about management, leadership, difficult people, difficult bosses, like all the weird things that you confront in work and life, and turned it into a book, essentially using like my story of like, here's 60 lessons and very applicable lessons with takeaways that you can apply to your specific life, almost all based on me screwing it up the first time and hopefully having enough humility and self-awareness to fix it. And I write a column called Finish Line, and I've just noticed that people are hungry for that type of content. I have a very blunt, direct delivery style, so I hope that that will resonate with readers. But to me, it's a book written for leaders, managers, college grads, like anyone who's trying to get ahead in life and at work in particular, and wants to know a couple of secrets that have worked for us and for a lot of other people. And I think if you apply them, you'll probably have a lot of success.
And that's Just the Good Stuff that comes on sale tomorrow.
Just the Good Stuff is the name. I appreciate you pushing it. And all the money from it goes to a foundation we created for kids who need help, who don't have the money to get vocational training or go to school. I don't profit from the book. It really is a passion project for me. I believe a lot, and I try to help other founders. I try to help managers. I feel very blessed to be in a position of leadership, and I love helping other people think through complicated things. Like, I just have this weird, I'm not wired like other people. Like, I don't really get affected by bad situations. Like, I could just look at it intellectually or look at it calmly and say, okay, this is a weird situation. How do you fix it? And what did I learn from it? And then I'm able to distill that and pass it on to other people that might help them in otherwise very tough decision points of life.
All right. My last two brief questions. First, what is a mistake that you have made in your career, and what did you learn from it?
You know, probably my biggest mistake and the one that changed my thinking the most was, it's no secret that the ending of Politico was not a happy ending. And I just allowed myself to sit in a situation where like too much of my day was eaten up by negativity and conflict. And what I learned from it is every one of us, if you can, should try to spend 90, 95% of your time doing things you like doing, that you're good at doing, with people you enjoy and who are life enhancing. And if you find yourself in a situation where that's not the case, and particularly when more than 50% of your time is soul sucking, get the hell out if you can. Like, life is too short. Even if you make a lot of money, or you love the gig that you have, or you love the people around you, you owe it to yourself to be in perpetual pursuit of being happier.
And second, what is some advice that you would give operators looking to grow their media businesses?
Like, reader first. Like, sit down and just study who it is that you is reading you, or that you want reading you, or listening to you, and you want listening to you. How do you serve them? Get on the phone with them. Ask them. Don't survey them, because like, that's not helpful. You pick up. The success comes from the nuance of the conversation. People don't actually know what they want, but they can't articulate what they want. But if you listen enough and you look closely enough at the data, you could start to see the future. And I think too often we think about what we want and not what the consumer needs.
If you enjoyed this episode, hit subscribe and give it a 5-star rating with your thoughts. If you want even more, sign up for AMO Pro at amediaoperator.com. Each Tuesday, we analyze the latest media news, and throughout the week, we do deep dives into specific strategic and tactical topics about building media businesses. Thanks for listening, and see you next week.